This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Are you currently playing anything right now? Do you still play video games?
Sometimes, yes. I watch other people play more than that. So right now, I've been watching my daughter play Stardew Valley.
Okay.
Oh, on the Switch.
Nice. And the Switch or the Switch 2?
The Switch, yeah. It's, okay. I mean, it looks like a 16-bit game, so you don't need the Switch 2 in order to engender the results.
Mm-hmm. I feel like when I was a kid, video games were very much, I don't know if the right word is stigmatized, but, you know, my parents would always tell me, like, oh, you don't want to waste your time playing video games. And now what video games have become, you know, people are making money from playing video games, like whether it's the esports or just streaming. So it's crazy where it's gone.
There was a Far Side cartoon that Gary Larson made in the 80s, and it was a bunch of parents looking at a want ad, and they saw their kids playing video games, and the want ad said, like, wanted must be able to defeat Bowser and win the princess in Super Mario Brothers. Wanted must be able to stop the monsters in Legend of Zelda. And then the idea was that it was ridiculous to think that being good at video games was a skill that someone would pay for. And nowadays, that is literally true. If you are a skilled enough and entertaining enough player of video games, you can have a whole career on Twitch, and people will watch you play video games.
For the video game that you mentioned, the Stardew Valley, is there a big community with that game?
There is a big community of it, yes. It's similar to Animal Crossing, except it's people instead of animals.
Oh, okay.
And it was all programmed by one person over a year and a half span. He just taught himself everything bit by bit and made all of the sprites, all of the animations, and kept on adding things to this world. And it's such a deep world, and it's such an intimate world because it's one person's unique view. And you know, he literally made every single sprite that it feels very much like a novel that you get to walk through. You're not aware of how much video games are collective works when you play them otherwise, because, you know, you have one person doing a graphics engine, you have someone else doing the animations, and another person doing the level design. But when there's one unified mind behind all of it, you can kind of almost tell.
Do you think that the normal, like, average video game player, do you think they realize, like what you were saying, like how much exactly goes into it, and maybe not even from the, like, software development of it, but from, like, the story of it and designing the characters? Do you think people realize the amount of work that goes into something like that?
I don't think it's possible to understand how much work goes into a big collective endeavor like this. Like, when you hear about $100 million budget movie, that's kind of par for the course. That's what you go to see in a movie theater now. But think about how much it would cost for you if you bought $1 million worth of food for people. You'd think, wow, how would I even cook that much? I don't even know that many people. I could feed everyone I know for months on end. And then you think about, like, you know, 100 times that much. Like, there's no way I can possibly make a project this big. So video games or watching sports athletes compete or watching a movie, any sort of big budget endeavor, you just can't imagine all of it. You can only imagine one little piece at a time. And it leads to kind of ridiculous things like saying, like, you know, Team A wanted a championship more than Team B, when that's clearly not the case. There's no way to reduce it to one person wanting it more than another. And when you're playing video games, it's very easy to say, like, oh, well, EA was just greedy. That's why they didn't put this thing in. When it's like, there's a lot of factors other than just EA's greed, which, sure, is there.
Well, really quick, Jeff, I will give you a proper introduction for everybody out there listening. Hi, my name is Chris. This is Chitash, and today I am joined by journalist, author. I mentioned the book earlier, one of his books earlier, Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America. Please welcome Jeff Ryan. Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. No, thanks for joining me. I love this topic. I'm getting more and more into like the history of video games, and I've really enjoyed your book so far. I was wondering to start things off if you can kind of go into your background and kind of how you got to where you're at today.
I fell into a job reviewing video games when I was in my 20s. That is the long and the short of it. There's no way of getting a job like this by earning it. If I needed to earn it, I would not have gotten it. I fell into it. I was at a job and they were paying a freelancer to review video games for them, and they didn't want to pay this freelancer anymore, and I was salaried. So they said, guess what? In addition to your regular job, you are the new video game editor for the website. So I did that for a couple of years, and I had a great couple of years. Then that job went away because the website went away. But I still had the knowledge of how the video game industry worked, and I was looking at it much more as a business enterprise than as a bunch of people that made fun games for us to play. So I took that and eventually turned it into a book about the history of Nintendo, because you can tell the history of all of video games just by Nintendo and what Nintendo did, and then what everyone else did to compete, because Nintendo had such a dominance on the industry for so long.
Do you think, are there other companies, or is Nintendo very unique, like with what you're saying in that regard, that they had such a foothold on, I don't know what you call it, like the market, that the story of video games is really Nintendo. It's not, you know, Microsoft, or it's not Sony. Nintendo is like the biggest like behemoth in this field. Or can you include other companies like, you know, Sony and Microsoft into this story?
You definitely could include them, because they are electronics and software companies, respectively. And Nintendo does both of that stuff, but Nintendo is a video game company first and foremost. If they stop making video games, they don't have a bunch of DVD players to, or Enterprise Suite software to go back on. It's like, we're still making billions of dollars from other endeavors. This is it for them.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. I'm shocked that... I'm shocked of the history of Nintendo, and actually like the very beginnings of this company, and how much it deviated to where it is today, because it wasn't always about video games. And you go over this in your book. I was wondering if you can touch on like what Nintendo came from initially, like what was it manufacturing or in the business of?
Okay, Nintendo starts about 100 years before you thought they started. They started in the 1890s or so, and they were making Hanafuda cards, which were the playing cards of Japan, and they were going into the casinos of Japan. And the casinos at the time destroyed the cards after every round, so they needed a lot of cards, so Nintendo was in the business of supplying the casinos with all their cards. And since they were making cards, they had a network of distribution into the toy stores of Japan to sell their cards. And that turned into, well, we have this network of toy stores, we might as well give them some toys as well. And then that moved into electronic toys. And then once the arcade game market started, that, well, it's just a big toy, so we can see if we can do something with the arcade game world.
As far as video games, when did Nintendo first delve into this market? This is like post World War II, right?
Yes. Yeah. Nintendo had a couple of rough years after World War II because it was a Japanese company and Japan had just lost a world war. So if you've seen Godzilla Minus One, The early years where everyone is like literally living in hovels and shacks and just trying to make enough food for the day, that's what it was like for much of the country for a number of years. So the fact that Nintendo as a company stayed around was remarkable, but they did anything and everything to stay around. They had love hotels, which was a Japanese nickname for hotels that rented by the hour, and you can figure out why you would rent a hotel by the hour instead of the day. They sold rice. They had a taxi concern for a little bit. But eventually they moved back to the toy distribution network, and that's what kept them going.
Hmm. Now, as far as video games are concerned, I'm always of the thought, like the first video game that I can think of is, you know, something like Pong. Is that kind of what birthed like the evolution of, hey, we're creating games for consumers, you know, in consumer enjoyment, or was there something before Pong that initiated all of this?
Pong is more or less exactly right. Pong in 1972 was considered the first big video game, the first game that you could go into a bar and you could actually watch and plunk down a quarter and you could play with someone else, and it was a huge amount of fun. And there are over 100 different Pong variants out there if you really want to be a completionist and try to collect them all. There was about 15 years worth of previous one-offs that were all trying to be the world's first video game, but they were individual units. So they weren't made for the masses the way Pong was. So I've played one of them. I've played a game called Computer Space, which existed technically before Pong, but it was very complicated to play. And this is literally the first video game anyone had ever seen, so they couldn't figure out how it worked. Pong is so much simpler. The entire instructions of Pong are avoid missing ball for high score. You can figure that out even if you've never played a game before.
It's sometimes, I feel like for me and for like others maybe around the same age as me, to realize that, you know, because I always grew up, we definitely had arcade games, and I definitely played arcade games when I would go. A very common place was bowling alleys. I would always see them, and we would play a bunch of them. But for the most part, I've been mostly like a console player or like on the PC. But the story of video games, and I guess Nintendo too, starts from arcade games and, you know, people putting in quarters, and they're going to these places like bars, like you mentioned, and playing these games. If you want to keep playing, you have to keep putting in quarters. And for Nintendo, that kind of starts with Donkey Kong. Is that correct? That was kind of like their first big arcade hit.
Yes, that was their huge hit. It wasn't their first game that they tried to sell in America, though. The first game they tried to sell was a knockoff of Space Invaders called Radar Scope. They weren't the first one to make a knockoff. They weren't even the third or the fourth. So when they trotted themselves around to all the different arcades of North America with yet another Space Invaders knockoff, no one was really interested. But they had presupposed that everyone would care, and they had made 3,000 arcade cabinets. And this was the critical mistake and the critical opportunity, because if they hadn't made 3,000 in advance, they would have just accepted, well, we sold 500, 600, let's make those and send them to America, and that's that. But since they made so many and shipped them to Seattle when spent all that expense, they now needed to move this product, a product that no one wanted to buy. So they eventually came up with a game-changing idea, which was quite literally to pull out the solid-state motherboard inside and change the game and replace it with something else. All of the real game designers at Nintendo were busy. They asked the guy who painted that cabinet red in order to design something, because he wasn't busy. That guy turned out to be Shigeru Miyamoto, the world's greatest game designer, and what he sent back to Seattle, Washington, was Donkey Kong.
This was also something interesting that I found in your book about Nintendo's presence in the States in the beginning, and how they, and correct me if I'm wrong, they had a focus on New York City as well, because of New York City's, you know, everybody, when people think of America, I think most people think New York City and the right. Toy market in New York City. And I was wondering if you could explain that, like why Nintendo kind of tried to dive into that market at first, and what made them move to Seattle.
Well, you nailed it when you said that New York City was the toy capital of the world. There's a toy fair every year in New York City. It doesn't move around. It's always in New York. That's where Toy Fair is. And it's been like that for generations. So they thought, well, we're making what's basically a toy. We might as well go to the toy capital of the world to try to sell it. And they had a lot of difficulties because this is a whole new world for them. And they are also a very small Japanese company. There were only 5 or 6 people that moved over to the States. And there was a lot of culture shock. New York City in the early 1980s, those are the people that killed John Lennon. It wasn't a fun place to be. So they eventually moved. They moved to the Pacific Northwest area, which has a lot more Asian and Asian Americans there. So it's a much friendlier place. They can have food that's familiar to them. It's a more pleasant environment, more similar to what Japan is like. And this is also a plan B, and it's 3,000 miles closer to Japan so that they can call home without having to be a literal 12-hour time difference.
What would you say is the biggest reason overall for Nintendo Real?
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail? Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Really going after the American market, because the only reason I could really think is just, you know, population and just the consumer spending in America is very different than, you know, a lot of other countries. I know other countries are a lot bigger, but is it just simply just to chase the money, chase the dollars?
Yeah, we are the whale. We are the single biggest market, and we're all one country that spreads 3,000 miles. If you want to sell something in Europe, this was before the European Union, which meant that each country needed to have its own labeling, its own series of forms you needed to fill out. It was a big pain. But if you could make it in America, then you could earn so much money that all of the other stuff would take care of itself. Europe would bend over backwards to try to get the hit American product. So that was always the plan. And it went back to when Nintendo, which was a toy company and a card company in the 60s, arranged a licensing deal with Disney. And they put some Disney characters on the back of their cards. And that's when they realized, well, we're selling to Japan. So the map of Japan, we're all over the place. But Disney has the map of the world. And when you look at Japan and a map of the world, it's just one little island. So there's so much more out there that we could be selling to than what we thought of as everything. When you expand your mind like that, it makes you feel small. So Nintendo wanted to feel big. Nintendo wanted to go after the whale.
As far as inside Japan, both maybe in the early years of video games, you know, in like the 70s and 80s, and as well as today, does Nintendo do very well with their Japanese audience? In other words, like, there's really no other competitor for them inside the country of Japan?
Nintendo is one of the most beloved companies in Japan, beloved all around the world, but Japan is always aware that there's a world audience out there. So, like, when you think of Studio Ghibli products or you think of Sanrio and Hello Kitty, those are popular around the world, and they're also popular in Japan. But one of the reasons they're popular in Japan is because they're known to be so popular around the world, that they are exportable characters. There's a huge amount of content that never gets exported out of Japan. That's just for local audiences. But the stuff that's international hits, that's what Japan really feels like. This is what's earned our reputation.
Have you ever been to Japan?
I have not yet been to Japan. I'd love to go. But before I sold the book, I just didn't have the money. We had two young kids. We couldn't bring four people to Japan. And now we may be able to, but, you know, it's still a very pricey trip. And you'd have to go for at least 2 weeks to get used to the time change. But it's on the bucket list.
Yeah, same for me. I had my brother went a couple years ago, and he actually visited the Nintendo Museum, and he said it was, he had a lot of fun. So definitely on my bucket list too.
And they have recently expanded that. It used to be that Nintendo's Kyoto headquarters was simply a nondescript office building, but so many people for so long had been making pilgrimages to Kyoto just to see Nintendo and then find out, oh, it's an office building and I'm not allowed in. So that Nintendo has opened up its own Kyoto Museum so that you feel like you've gotten your money's worth out of your Japanese trip. You get to see the history of Nintendo, not just the outside of an office building.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that... Definitely, hopefully soon, I make my way over there. You mentioned a gentleman earlier, and one of the figures that's like at the forefront of the company, Shigeru Miyamoto. And
yes.
I was wondering if you could talk about him for a second. Like, who exactly is he? Kind of what his background was at the company? How important is he to the company, etc.?
Shigeru Miyamoto is basically Japan's George Lucas mixed in with Japan's Steven Spielberg. In terms of the creativity, in terms of the childlike glee, in terms of everyone knowing and loving him, in terms of his actual fame, he liked to bike to work, but he had to stop doing it because he kept being recognized. And also they realized, you know, sometimes people who bike to work get hit by cars. We can't lose this guy. So he wasn't allowed to bike to work anymore. He had started off as a staff artist, which meant he was basically an engineer, like a Mr. Fix-It. And he, after Donkey Kong, he was assigned to develop video games. And he eventually came up with a way of developing game after game after game that were incredible trendsetters, that each one created its own new genre of game. Many of them star Mario, but they're all different games. If you think about Super Smash Brothers or Mario Kart, those both star Mario, but they're not side-scrolling adventures the way that the classic Super Mario Brothers is. They're all different genres. And the way that he works is finding a fun exercise that he does in the world and then deciding how that can turn into a video game. Like, he had gotten a little chubby in middle age and decided to go on a diet. And he liked the idea of tracking his calories, tracking his exercise, and getting a new report every day when he stepped on the scale. And that's where Wii Fit came from, the idea that he enjoyed going on a diet. And he also enjoyed gardening in his backyard, and that's where we got a franchise called Pikmin, which is very, very far removed from gardening, but does take place in a garden. So he took the original idea of it's fun to garden and came up with something truly, truly wonderful.
That's really cool. I did not know that about Pikmin. So his role, he's still around today. Has his role changed at all over the years, like at present?
It's definitely changed, yes. I think he would have liked to retire, but there are some golden handcuffs that are keeping him there at Nintendo. And he also is not involved in game design the way that he was before. He has a more supervisory role. And so there's still the legend that Miyamoto is working on all of these games, that Miyamoto is just, you know, spending 12 hours a day figuring out what the next Mario title is going to be. But he's not. Other people are doing that. Other people who are inspired by him and are working in his shadow and his aegis, but he's not individually coding the way that they are doing it. But they give him all sorts of tribute, and they say that they're working in his spirit. But they should be getting the credit for it, because they are the ones who are the new innovators and the new trailblazers.
Could the story of Nintendo have been any different if it wasn't Mario, if it was one of the other beloved characters that Nintendo has, like a Zelda, or maybe even like a Pikachu? Like, what makes Mario in that universe like so universal that it's so pervasive, like a Disney, like you mentioned earlier?
Right. This is a wonderful core fundamental question, and it's hard to ask it, but you've asked it in a very good way, which is what made Mario popular? It wasn't the side-scrolling, because you could put another character in the side-scrolling adventure and it wouldn't feel as good. So is it just that collection of sprites? Is it the fact that he's a working-class guy? Is it that he's like a middle-aged guy with a little bit of a belly? What is it that particularly is working? And the best answer I can get is that it's not any of those things. It's not even all of those things. It's just that Mario happened to be the character that they designed and was put into a popular franchise. And so we accepted him. We accepted his face. We accepted his movement, his musculature, his physical presence. We accepted all of that as part of the package deal. The same way that if you think about a great actor like Meryl Streep, like if Meryl Streep had different facial features, would she still be Meryl Streep? Well, yes and no. Meryl Streep has a very distinctive nose. It's hard to imagine Meryl Streep with a different nose than Meryl Streep. I wrote a book about Mickey Mouse after I wrote a book about Super Mario, and the same questions about Mickey Mouse apply to Mario. What is it about Mickey Mouse that made him so beloved? Is it that we love mice more than rats? Is it the fact that he was a mammal instead of a bird or a lizard or a turtle? They're unanswerable questions unless we have some sort of Uchronia time machine, but I think the ultimate answer is that it doesn't really matter. And furthermore, if you try to make a character designed for popular appeal, it's not going to work. You're not going to get that popular appeal. If you try to make a cool character, the kids and the young at heart will see through it as the false attempt it is. But if you just happen to design a mouse, or if you just happen to design a plumber, then people will say, well, yeah, that works, and I like who this person is. And I like Meryl Streep's nose.
One part of this history that I wasn't as familiar with, and it didn't just affect Nintendo, seemed like it affected everybody, was this crash that happened in video games in the 1980s. And I was wondering if you could talk about that. Like, what exactly happened? Do we know, like, why exactly people kind of stopped buying video games in this certain time period?
Okay, so starting from the mid-70s, Atari was selling the VCS, which was then turned into the 2600, and millions of people bought them, and each one of those millions of people bought, 5 to 10 video games. And this sounded like a great sort of razor blades and razors business model, where so long as you get the console into the house, then people are buying these $40, $35 games every month or so. So everyone wanted to chase that business model. Everyone wanted to make the hardware. Everyone wanted to make the software. But no one was able to get the user base that Atari did. But because of that, the electronics stores were filled with dozens and dozens of different consoles and computers that weren't interchangeable with each other. And each one of them had their own suite of proprietary games and software. And no one had the market base. No one had the install base in order to be successful. And so the game makers weren't making money, and the electronics stores weren't making money. And the consumers, no matter what they bought, felt like, well, I'm only getting 7% of the games in the market. So that ended up leading to the crash. There was just too much of everything out there, and no one had the market share.
On the other side of that, what kind of popped everything back into place? Like, what got us, or I guess Nintendo or any of these other companies, what got them out of the crash? Like, people just all of a sudden started buying games again?
One reason why we got out of the crash was that it was only the North American video game crash. We had talked before about how America was the whale, the biggest market out there, and lots of people launched their product exclusively in North America. So in Japan, the crash never happened. In Europe, the crash never happened. They had a whole different suite of consoles and computers that were out there. A smaller number, but it was a more stable install base. So it was only in North America, the biggest market, where all of a sudden, for a five-year period, no one seemed to be interested in buying video games, and no one was allowed to sell them or the video game hardware. So that was where Nintendo had a huge stroke of luck, because they were launching the Famicom, the family computer, which became very popular in Japan, and they rebranded it as the Nintendo Entertainment System, or NES, the gray box that is so iconic and familiar with the 1980s. They launched that at a time where all of America was now super, super hungry for a video game system, and here comes Nintendo like a savior delivering it to them.
I was maybe a little bit too not quite around yet for the NES. I grew up with mostly like an N64, but I definitely am familiar with the NES. As far as other setbacks for Nintendo, because it wasn't just this crash in North America. There was also some mishaps, or maybe flops, you could call them, with some of its games. One that comes to mind from reading your book was the second installment in the Mario Brothers series, where, you know, Mario Brothers is so beloved and hugely popular, and then all of a sudden trying to make a sequel for it, it maybe doesn't exactly live up to the hype. Did Nintendo have a lot of troubles or like issues trying to make a sequel, trying to keep their momentum going?
So there are lots and lots of video game sequels now and then. Nintendo tried something novel when it made a sequel to Super Mario Brothers, which is that they tried to make it feel like the next levels of the first game. So the first Super Mario Brothers ends on level 7.2, and the difficulty level had been ramping up. Level 4.2 is harder than level 3.2, and so on. So they wanted to make a game that started at difficulty level 8.1. And they succeeded. And that's one reason why it was not a popular game, because it was super hard. Something else to remember going back to the early 80s and the console era was that games were designed to be hard, because the harder a game was, the quicker you lost your quarter and the quicker you put the next quarter in. So it took a while for video game makers to realize that the point of the game was not to subtract people from their quarters as quickly as possible, because this is a home console game. You already have all the quarters. You don't need to punish the player by killing them right away. You can make it.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. November is Men's Health Awareness Month, so Talkspace wants guys to know that being prepared for life's biggest challenges and opportunities means prioritizing mental health too. Talkspace can help you go beyond fine-tuned workouts, supplements, and productivity hacks. Talkspace can help you fine-tune your inner life so you can succeed in being the best version of yourself in any situation. And with Talkspace, you can get therapy from anywhere and on your time. You can even text your therapist between sessions. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace takes most insurance, and most insured members have a $0 copay. Men's Health Awareness Month is the perfect time to reach out to Talkspace. Now, get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com. That's Talkspace.com, promo code SPACE80.
Easier on them. Like, if you've never played Donkey Kong and you think, oh, I'll download it on the emulator or I'll put a quarter in at a retro arcade, Donkey Kong is super hard. You die right away. You don't even get to the end of the first level before you've lost all three of your Marios. And you think, wow, I didn't know how hard this game was. And that was par for the course for all of the early 80s games, Donkey Kong especially. There's a reason why we're still playing Donkey Kong. It's still a very hard, challenging game.
That's interesting, because you've heard of this in today's day and age of video games, that there's some video games out there that are almost too easy, or they're too handholdy. Like, they really like baby you through some of these games. Have you heard that, like, in today's day and age?
Yes, and Nintendo, because they're making all ages games, has embraced a lot of that. On the new Mario games, they have something called Assist Mode. And Assist Mode is basically easier than easy mode, because if you don't know where to go, there will be a big blue arrow pointing you to your next objective. And when Mario gets injured in Assist Mode, all he needs to do is stand back and wait, and he regains his hearts. So both of these would seem like, no, you need to find a place to heal yourself if you want to heal up. And you know, you need to remember what your next obstacle is, or go somewhere to give you a clue. You don't have it given to you like a constant GPS. But we're in an age where we're looking for something different in video games. We're not necessarily looking for a challenge. We're looking for enjoyment. You can enjoy something without it being incredibly difficult.
And it's with Nintendo... It's not just maybe some of their, like we have the video game crash, we have some other games that did not do well. And it's not just those things, it's also other companies like entering the picture and starting to maybe put pressure on Nintendo. And the one company that I can think of, and you've talked about in your book, and it's funny, I actually have another book on my bookshelf called Console Wars, which is all about the...
By this, Blake J. Harris, yes.
Yes, yeah. And you have this company, Sega, who branded themselves in a different way that kind of... it was like a dichotomy to what Nintendo represented. And I was wondering if you could talk about what Sega meant to Nintendo, like where did they come from, and how they butted heads with Nintendo.
So Sega was a competitor to Japan in the for decades, and then in the early 80s they had the Sega Master System, which was an 8-bit system along with the NES, and it sold a tenth, if that, of the NES units. So Nintendo was not ever worried about Sega. There's even a quote that I found that a Nintendo executive said about Sega, which is, "Sega is nothing. Therefore, no matter what Sega does, we're not going to respond. We're not going to dignify it. We're just going to keep on moving around with 95% market share," or whatever they had. And this made Nintendo vulnerable, because they said, no matter what you do, we're not going to respond. So Sega had a very aggressive attempt to find an audience that Nintendo was not responding to, which was teenagers who were aging out of playing the babyish Nintendo games. And Sega branded itself as the high school version of a Nintendo. This is where the teenagers could go. If you watched MTV instead of Nickelodeon, you needed to switch from the NES to the Genesis. And that's where Sonic the Hedgehog came from. Sega's mascot character was a kid named Alex Kidd, and he was an attempt to try to be super cool as a fun kid, but it just wasn't clicking with audiences. So they moved to a new character who was super fast, had a lot of attitude, was literally like a ball of spikes wearing sneakers, which was a very big deal because people just didn't wear sneakers in the 1980s other than basketball players. So all of that combined together, along with a very good, fast game, and the Genesis was able to do things that Nintendo couldn't in terms of the number of colors it generated and number of speed. So Nintendo literally could not port over the Sonic the Hedgehog game onto the SNES if it wanted to. All of this combined to make Sega and the Genesis are a real competitor to Nintendo, and before Nintendo realized it, it was in a two-horse race.
So is that an American company originally?
It is, yes. Sega stands for Service Games. It's it sounds very Japanese, but it's American.
Was there ever any sort of... Did the rivalry extend beyond video games to, like, oh, we have a company, Sega, which is American, we have Nintendo, which is Japanese? Did it kind of transcend video games into like political or I don't know cultural aesthetics? Like, we need to support this American company here in America and not support, you know, Nintendo products?
There was a lot of cultural issues on the Nintendo side and on the Sega side. You can find both Nintendo and Sega executives who said that Nintendo's real rival, Nintendo of America's real rival, was Nintendo of Japan, and Sega execs saying the same thing. Our problem wasn't Nintendo. Our problem was our bosses in Japan. Sega started off as an American company, but became popular in Japan, so much so that it's now often seen as a Japanese company. But Yugi Naga, the man who designed Sonic the Hedgehog and made a lot of the Sonic games, moved to Los Angeles and moved a studio to Los Angeles because he felt like, if I'm making games for primarily American audiences, I want to be in America. I want to experience American culture to get it right, because I'm not making this ultimately for a Japanese audience. And Nintendo games were still always made with a Japanese audience primarily in mind.
You mentioned that the title character of Sonic, Sonic games of themselves, when they started rolling out, were they doing pretty well, like selling well, and it was a pretty popular like game or mascot here in the States?
It was. One way that they made Sonic their main character and associated Sonic with Sega instead of anyone else was consoles used to come with what was called pack-in games. So if you bought a Nintendo, it came with a free copy of Super Mario Brothers. And if you bought the Nintendo Entertainment System with the Zapper, it came with a game called Duck Hunt as well. And when you bought a Genesis at first, it came with a game called Altered Beast, where you were a fighter and then you turn into a werewolf or a monster and then you were able to punch extra hard. And that was a fun game for a while, but they realized that Sonic was so popular that they didn't want to get an extra sale from each person by having to sell them Sonic the Hedgehog. They wanted the branding, and they wanted the reputation that Sonic had to be such a key part of the Genesis that they swapped the pack-in game. So every new purchase of the Genesis came with Sonic the Hedgehog now.
The comparison that you made, or what you said earlier about how Sonic was kind of seen as like this edgier character really tailored towards like a teenage audience, kind of reminds me of when the PlayStation 2 came out in like 2001, I believe, and the advertising for the PlayStation 2 seemed like it was more geared towards like kind of rougher, edgier content. You know, you had like Crash Bandicoot, you had like Jack and Daxter, versus yep. You have Mario and Peach, and it just seemed different. I don't know if that's like a fair comparison, would you say?
No, that's fair. They were going for the older gaming audience, because this was now at a point where a lot of people who had been gaming in the 80s and 90s are now adults in their 20s and 30s, and they never stopped the video game habit. They're still playing, and they don't necessarily need to play Mario games. Maybe they still are, because they're still good games, but if you're looking for a daily driver as a video game platform and you're 25 years old, you'd rather have the PlayStation 2, because the PlayStation 2 is giving you a whole lot of great M-rated games that you can play. And with Nintendo, almost all of its good first-party games are going to be E-rated for everyone. And, you know, there's a reason why a bunch of adults aren't going to see Pixar movies. Pixar movies are for kids and for families. The R-rated movies are for the adults.
So, yeah, it's kind of like, would you rather play Mario Kart, or would you rather play, like, Gran Turismo or Need for Speed, something like that?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The trappings of the game are the same. The gameplay is often similar, but the looks of it are very different. Like, my brother will play Rage Against the Machine on audio when he's playing Mario Kart, because he's trying to line up how he feels playing the game with how the game looks, and how the game looks is not how it makes him feel. But having said that, Nintendo games always look good. They look good for the whole family, even if they engender a lot of rage when you're playing with other people. And people are often going for the look. So part of the look is edginess. And this is the era of Grand Theft Auto 3 and all of the Tony Hawk games. And, you know, it's listening to rap rock music.
Going back to Sega, with what everything we were saying with how well received, you know, Sonic was with that particular audience, what exactly then happened to Sega? Because it kind of seemed like it just kind of fell off of a cliff at some point. So how was Nintendo able to just kind of overtake its rival
Sega had a very bold strategy after the Genesis, and it turned out to not be a successful strategy. They wanted to make lots of different subversions of the Genesis. So you could attach something called the 32X, and there was a CD drive that you could put on, and both of those would give you access to an expanded caliber of games. But there were only a few sets of games for each one of them, and they basically had made three different consoles at the time, one with the CD add-on and one with the 32X add-on. And then there were games that required both the CD player and the 32X, so now we have four different types of video games that need to be designed. And if you bought one of these games, you were one of the few who did. And they kept on making more and more versions. They made a portable Game Gear called the Nomad, or a portable Genesis called the Nomad. They made something called the Pico, which was like for kids. And there were just too many different types of hardware out there and not enough software supporting any of it. Nintendo, on the other hand, kept people playing the SNES and nothing but the SNES for a long time. And Nintendo has always made a lot of money off of its hardware. They have an expression calling the seasoned use of withered technology, which means that you're not buying top-of-the-line parts when you buy a product that Nintendo made. You're buying something with older parts that are more easily accessible and understandable and able to be used by engineers and game designers. And that also means that Nintendo is able to buy them for cheaper and make more money off of it. Like, if you bought a PlayStation 5, no matter how much you paid for it, Sony isn't making much money off of you. Sony will make more money in a couple of years when you buy a PlayStation 5 for maybe $100 less, but it now will cost them $200 or $300 less to manufacture a PS5 because they'll have more learnings, more ways of designing and building more efficiently. Nintendo is making that money from the very first day for each console.
We mentioned a lot of setbacks for Nintendo. You know, you have, you know, some of the video games not doing well, the crash, you have this big rivalry with Sega. I didn't even mention earlier, but you mentioned in your book about that they were sued by Universal Studios, I believe. And it just seems like every now and again, they're being, you know, kind of punched in the mouth a little bit and they're being beaten back, but every time it just seems Nintendo bounces back and they find a way to overcome these challenges. And is there anything that you could kind of pinpoint to what helps them kind of just keep trucking and keep going no matter the obstacle?
I think it's the same thing that leads to a lot of their problems. For every one obstacle, an external obstacle that they face and overcome, there is a self-inflicted wound where they've shot themselves in their foot, and then they have to deal with that problem. Like in the 1980s, when the NES was super popular, they decided they didn't want to have a flood of games, so they limited every game maker to only releasing 5 games a year. And they further throttled how many copies of each game each third-party game maker was able to put out. And they wouldn't know until a game came out. So if Konami gets the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle license and says, we're going to sell 3 million copies of this for Christmas time, Nintendo may come back and say, well, you may want to, but we're only going to give you 100,000 chips. So you can only make 100,000 of these at max, which puts a real ceiling on the potential of selling. So a company like Konami found a way out of this because they made a whole second company, a shell company called Ultra, simply to...
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. November is Men's Health Awareness Month, so Talkspace wants guys to know that being prepared for life's biggest challenges and opportunities means prioritizing mental health, too. Talkspace can help you go beyond fine-tuned workouts, supplements, and productivity hacks. Talkspace can help you fine-tune your inner life so you can succeed in being the best version of yourself in any situation. And with Talkspace, you can get therapy from anywhere and on your time. You can even text your therapist between sessions. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace takes most insurance, and most insured members have a $0 copay. Men's Health Awareness Month is the perfect time to reach out to Talkspace. Now, get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com. That's Talkspace.com, promo code SPACE80.
Sell 5 more Konami games per year branded by this other name. And it was a very open secret, and other companies did this also, making shell companies so they could sell 10 games instead of 5. But they still had the problem that Nintendo ultimately decided how many chips each one of these companies got per game. So you couldn't make that much money selling a Nintendo game, even if you had a hit game. And that's where Sega really stepped up to the plate. They realized we can treat our third-party game makers with a lot of respect. We can give them an unlimited number of chips, however much they want. We can make it a more pleasant experience to make games for Sega than for Nintendo.
Have you heard of this phrase? I've heard this phrase thrown around a little bit whenever I watch a YouTube content about Nintendo and games for any of the consoles. That Nintendo is the Disney of video games.
That phrase makes a lot of sense. Yes, they're for both Mario and Mickey, the face of the character is associated with the company, is associated with children's entertainment, is associated with generations and generations of families in enjoying their product, is now associated with theme parks and movies.
Now, there's some of the YouTube comments definitely have, and it could be anywhere, not just YouTube, but there's feedback that is definitely positive for Nintendo in today's day and age. And there's some criticism, too, of Nintendo and kind of what people say, what they have become. Are you kind of privy to, like, some of the criticism? Have you heard, like, good arguments, like, kind of for or against kind of what Nintendo practices in this current day and age? And maybe, like, as one example, some people say that, you know, it's all about money now, and kind of some of the magic, so to speak, has been lost. Have you heard any of those things?
I have heard a lot of criticism about Nintendo and its very aggressive stance on piracy. So Nintendo will protect its intellectual property in a way that other companies don't. And some of this is because they are at heart a software company. And I know people who love playing their Switch and have yet to buy a single game for the Switch. They can just download it. They know places. It's not hard to do to find a place like this. You can probably just pick the right words and put it into a search engine, then you find a place and you can download the games for free, and you don't need to pay anyone, and you get your $60 game every week, and you're up to date with all of the new games that people are playing, and you've never paid anyone a cent. This is what Nintendo really doesn't want to happen. They'd much rather you spend the $60 and buy a game a month than by downloading all of the games. So this is why they're so aggressively cracking down, but they're cracking down on people who consider themselves Nintendo fanboys. And so there's a lot of dislike of Nintendo because they're cracking down the same way that in the 90s Disney started to crack down on people that were illegally using their intellectual property. And when I mean illegally using, I mean painting a mural of Aladdin in a daycare center. Disney forced one person to stop doing that, and they've been haunted by it ever since.
I have heard of things like Super Smash Brothers tournaments that are really popular. I know a lot of folks compete in Super Smash Brothers, and I've heard things that, like, Nintendo has shut down some of these tournaments because it's not directly sanctioned by Nintendo. I don't know if that's something you've heard as well.
Yes, but for people who are saying that this is based on Nintendo's greed, I think that's the wrong vice / virtue. Because if Nintendo was a greedy company, there would be a million things that they would do differently. We get one Metroid game per console generation. If Nintendo was a greedy company, they would be making so-so Metroid games every single year. Military shooters are the most popular game and have been for 20 years. Nintendo went 20 years without ever making one because it didn't have any ideas for them. And then when it finally did come out with a military-style shooter, that was Splatoon, which no one actually thinks of as a military-style shooter, but it's the same gameplay, just has totally different trappings because it's this wild, wacky paintball world. So, and look at the movies. They made a not well-received Super Mario Brothers movie in 1993, and then that was it. It was crickets for the video game movie world for the next couple of decades. The Super Mario Brothers movie that eventually came out in 2023 and made $1 billion, that was 10 years in development, and 7 of those 10 years was simply the people at Illumination begging Nintendo to let them make the movie, and then 3 years of actually making the movie.
Looking to the future, and this year the Switch 2 came out, and with this company, Nintendo, what can you say about the future? Is it still, you know, they're still going to be innovating and winning, you know, the hearts of people and producing, you know, tremendous video games? What do you see in their future?
If you look at the console cycles that Nintendo puts out, there's a rise and fall and rise and fall. The N64 was a rise, followed by the GameCube, which was a fall, followed by the Wii, which was a rise, followed by the Wii U, which was a fall, followed by the Switch, which was a rise, and now we have a Switch 2 out. And the worry is that the Switch 2 is going to be another fall, that people are quite happy with the Switch. They don't see that much more graphical intensity or stuff that they can do with the Switch 2 that they can't do with the Switch. They're going to stick with the Switch. So in 5 years' time, we'll know that if it's a fall or not. But people forget how daring a plan making the Nintendo Switch was. Because as great as all of the consoles are, the home consoles that attach to your TV, that really wasn't where Nintendo made most of its money. Most of its money came from handheld games, from the 3DS way back to the original Game Boy, and before that to the Game & Watch series. So by making the Switch, which was a handheld game that you could connect to your TV, they got rid of all of the handheld possible sales because they merged them in with the console sales. And this meant that they basically were putting all of their chips onto one console instead of two. And they got rid of the more popular one, the one that made them more money, in terms of the one that would be more prestigious and allow for better games to be made. And this turned out to be a wildly successful move. So Nintendo is not afraid of making big, big risks.
I think I mentioned it earlier when we started, I still play my 3DS that my brother gave me. I still love it. I like playing Pokemon, and it's not just Pokemon. They like Legend of Zelda remakes on the 3DS. Yeah, I still like the handheld systems. Have a lot
and
of fun.
And it's a quality piece of hardware. It's probably 10 years old, the one you have, and it's still working.
Oh yeah, yeah, it still holds up. Maybe the battery life has kind of drained a little bit, but it still holds up, like you said. I still love playing it. As we kind of wrap up here, I wanted to ask you about your other book that you had mentioned about Mickey Mouse. And I did not realize this relationship between you have Walt Disney and then you have another animator, illustrator, and I forget his name.
His name's Oob Iwerks. It's a very unusual name, but it's hard to forget once you remember it. Oob Iwerks. U-B. That's his whole first name.
Oob Iwerks, yes. What was, I just kind of briefly, like, what is the story there between these two guys and Mickey Mouse?
Well, if you think of Walt Disney as the Steve Jobs of Disney, he needed a Steve Wozniak. He needed a tech guy who maybe wasn't the most gregarious person, but was doing all of the work behind the scenes. And that was Oob Iwerks. So Walt and Oob worked together for a decade at Disney, making all sorts of wonderful cartoons and innovating brand new things. And then some ups and downs happened, and Mickey Mouse came out as a result of it. Mickey Mouse became the world's first popular color cartoon, not color cartoon, but sound cartoon. And one of the things that Oob did as an innovator was figure out how to make a sound cartoon. He found some technology other people were using and put it to a brand new sort of use. But within 1 year of Mickey's success, the success went to Walt's head. And Oob, who owned 20% of Disney at the time, felt like he was being treated like an employee instead of a partner and doing all of the work and getting none of the benefits. So he sold his 20% share and became Walt's competitor and made the world's first color cartoon as a shot across the bow. Walt, for his sake, then erased Oob's name from the corporate history and said that he had invented Mickey Mouse by himself.
Wow. Wow, that's...
So that's the book. Everything leading to the breakup and then finding out what happened to Oob and why Oob wasn't more successful if he was the brain and the bronze behind Disney.
In all of your books, how hard is it to do research for them? And what types of sources are you using? Are you using like other like books, newspaper articles, online sources? Do you ever interview people for your books?
I have done interviews. For the Disney book, it was hard because everyone I wanted to interview has been dead for 50 years. So that puts a little bit of a crimp in it. But I found a wonderful resource, which was that a man named Richard Hubler was hired by the Disney family in 1967 to write an authorized biography of Walt Disney. He did this, but his interview style was very brusque. He wanted to get all of the good stories, so he was pushing people, give me your best drunk Walt Disney story. And this was, just months after the man had died. So he gets his stories and he writes a very fair-minded book, but his family does not like the fact that he was so mean and aggressive in his interviews. So when he hands in the book, they say, this isn't ever coming out. That's one of the downsides of writing an authorized biography. If the family doesn't like what you write, or if they don't like you, your book doesn't come out. So there's only one copy of this book that exists, which was his hand-typed copy. So he kept it. When he died, his papers were donated to Boston University. I found it. I tracked it down. I spent 2 days cosplaying as Mickey Mouse because it's an archive and I needed to wear white gloves while I was reading the manuscript. And I got 40 pages of notes, all including all of these interviews that he did with all these great old-time animators, including Oob.
Have you ever seen the movie? I forget the name of it, but it's with Tom Hanks and he plays Walt Disney.
Yes, it's called Saving Mr. Banks.
Okay, yes. I find stuff, and I've never seen the movie, but maybe I should now, especially, and we're talking about your other book about Walt and Oob. Just any sort of like corporate history really, really interests me. And I mentioned I have the Council Wars book. I also have Disney War by James B. Stewart. Which is also on my reading list. But just all of this history about these companies just is really, really interesting. And I find like your level of depth that you go into is just out of this world, the amount of information that you know.
Well, the information is out there. It's just if you have an interest in finding it via whatever sources, books or newspaper articles or blog posts or watching old documentaries, and if you have a cohesive way of telling the story, like a bookcase to put all these facts on, and if you figure out there's a way I can align these in a certain way so that it tells a certain narrative story, then you're off to the races. And it's something I really love doing. I love reading books about this stuff, and after I read 100 of them on the same subject, I get 101st, which is the one I wrote.
And speaking of that, is there currently anything right now that you're working on?
I am working on a couple of projects, yes. I had books on the history of Princess Leia and Spider-Man come out recently. So the audiobook of Spider-Man is finally, it's called Father and Son Issues, about a family of artists who've been working at Marvel for 60 years drawing Spider-Man. So that's the father and the son, and the issues are issues of Spider-Man. That is finally coming out on audio on January of 2026. I'm not sure what the 2-year delay was, but you'll finally be able to listen to it if you're an audiobook guy like I am.
Does anybody ever ask you about like advice? Like, does anybody ever ask you about writing advice? Like, hey, I have this great idea. I just don't know where to start. Like if somebody asked you that, what would you tell them?
I can pass on great advice I got from someone else. There's a guy who's been writing Simpsons scripts for decades named John Swartzwelder. And his take is that he's a horrible writer, but a great editor. So if he's assigned, like, let's say Homer gets a monster truck, that's your Simpsons episode. He will spend one day and write a terrible, terrible first draft. And then he's done with. Now he doesn't have to write the first draft. Now he has the second draft. Now he can improve on it. And he will spend 2 months improving that terrible first draft. But he needs to write that terrible first draft to get it down on paper to get rid of the terrible blank page. And once he does that, then he feels like, I'm a terrible writer, but I'm a great editor. So I can put my editor hat on and I can fix what all of this bad writer's mistakes are. And then he hands in a wonderful script. So if anyone is stuck on the blank page, not knowing where to start, think about John Swartzwelder's advice. Just put something down, as bad as it is, because then you have it and then you can always fix it.
I like that a lot. Thank you for sharing that. I kid you not, I wrote that down. So thank you for that. One last thing, for anybody who wants to connect with you, are you on any social media at all?
I have a Substack I send out every week. It's called Character Limitations, and I'm at jeffryan.com. Someone else owns jeffryan.com, so I have jeffryan.com.com. And I'm not really on social media because I've spent enough time reading about video games that I think about the world in terms of gamification. And I'm not good with the social media gamification, which is when I make a post and I get fewer than 10,000 likes, I feel like, oh, I totally failed. And because of that, I don't like the feeling of constant failure, so I don't post anything and then no one follows me. And this was like 3 or 4 social media cycles ago. So now I have like 12 followers and I post something once a year, and I don't know why I have so many followers. All of 12? I don't post anything for those 12 people. But long story short, no, I'm basically not on social media.
Okay. For your books, do you usually tell people, you know, grab them on Amazon, or would you rather people go to the website?
You can get them wherever you like to get books. So if you want the ebooks, read them that way. Audiobooks, you can probably still find some copies of the Mario one in the library, but the other ones, wherever you want to buy your books is fine. Small bookstores are, of course, you know, better because you're not feeding Amazon, but not everyone has a small bookstore by them.
Jeff, this has been fantastic. I really do appreciate you coming on, and your the amount of facts that you know is just unparalleled. So
well, if you had asked me a question I didn't know, I don't know if I'd say I don't know, or if I'd make up something and hope that you wouldn't call me on it. But I didn't make anything up this time, at least.
No, thank you so much for coming on. I will definitely include links to your website and the Substack in the description of the podcast. And thank you again. And for everybody out there who's been listening, my name is Chris. This has been Chitesh. Take care, everybody.